Welcome, dear Advantage Podcast Listeners and dear Patreons. Hallo und herzlich willkommen, liebe Advantage Podcast Hörerinnen und Patreons. Today, an English episode, and that has special reasons, important reasons. I'm very proud and also very thankful that my good colleague and also friend and one of the most accomplished doping experts in the recent years is here with me. Hello, Edmund.
Hi, Yannick. Thanks for having me again. Very much looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to the whole week since the news broke out. So we just for your information, for you all, we are recording on Sunday afternoon, 25th of August, four or five days after the news broke out, after the ITIA published the news that Yannick Sinner had two positive doping tests and was cleared to continue to play. Since then, a lot has happened in the tennis world, on tennis Twitter and in the media. A lot of rumors, a lot of stats, a lot of realities. And what we try to do today is to give you the best possible overview about this topic. And I consider myself as a tennis doping expert in the German area, but a lot of my views and a lot of my strength in this topic are connected to you and to our relationship that goes way back. And before we start with the Sinner case, we want to talk a bit about how we met and about doping in general and about doping and tennis, just 10-15 minutes, maybe 20. Let's see. when we start talking, there's a lot to say. And then we will focus entirely on the Sinner case. And as you know, I'm a German freelance journalist, so English is my second language. Edmund is from London, so have a bit patience with me, and Edmund also will talk a bit more slowly than he would probably on an English-based tennis podcast, but we will publish the podcast as well on our socials, so we welcome also a lot of English and international listeners to this episode, because we want to give you this experience to a lot of people. A lot of tennis fans, a lot of sport fans that maybe don't follow doping on a daily basis like we did. Yes. First of all, Edmund, besides that, it's nice to be here. Do you remember still how we met in 2019?
Yes, I think you were coming for a job interview at ARD German Television, and I was part of the sports investigative team there, and I heard there was someone from Tennis Magazine who was coming into the office, so I was like, oh, we should have a chat and talk doping in tennis, and sort of, yeah, we've been in contact since then.
Yeah, it was a crazy and also funny day, because actually it was not a real job interview, it was more like a background talk to get to know each other with Hajo Seppelt, which most of you guys know, obviously, who covered up the Russian-founded, state-founded doping in 2015, and a lot of other cases, obviously, are the doping redaction. And the talk was very nice, but only like for 10 to 20, 25 minutes. Very nice. I was very young at that time and just started my journalistic journey. But then I was in the kitchen of the RD doping redaction, and then I had another talk with Edmund Willison for, let's say, 2 hours. And we talked for 90% of the time about tennis and doping, and it was like a whole new experience, because I thought that I knew a lot about this topic and that I cared a lot about this topic, but you gave me so much more, and we changed numbers, and since then we are in contact, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we've worked together, and continuing to, and always investigating all things doping.
Yeah, it's so funny. Also, I didn't count it, but I think we published together 4 to 6 pieces in the end that were published. One of the or the most popular one was in the Daily Mail 2 years ago when we wrote about that the ITF shortly before the start of the ITIA. When the ITF, or it was also after the ITIA, I don't remember correctly, but it was about that tests on at least 3 professional tournaments, Masters tournaments, and Grand Slam tournaments, that players got noticed that there will be tests at the tournament, which is against the WADA code rules. And we published that with proof from players and data. And yeah, that was one of the stories that afterwards got read a lot. And also there were a bit change in the ITIA, which does the testing now, and we know by facts and quotes that they didn't do it since then, the way, which is a good thing. But let me say something to the listeners. If you say maybe, okay, they know each other since 2019 and only published 5 times together, it's very difficult to get things about doping published in terms of lawsuits, informations, and everything. So, like our ideas, we had maybe hundreds of ideas, but it's difficult then to get to the last point, right?
For sure, for sure.
Yes. So, maybe we should get everyone on the same page first. What was your first contact with doping or with the topic doping? Why you got interested in this topic in the first place?
So I guess when I was growing up, I was quite into track and field, so athletics. And in sort of the mid 2000s, there was the Balco scandal, which was in San Francisco. And a US chemist by the name of Victor Conte was arrested, and he'd been supplying drugs to lots of American athletes, the most famous being Marion Jones, the former sprinter who won 5 Olympic medals at Sydney 2000. And she's now had them taken away. But he had also provided drugs to a sprinter called Dwayne Chambers. And that was a very big story in the UK. I was actually a fan of Dwayne Chambers at the time. And ever since then, really, I've been interested in it. So since I was a very young age. And it all went from there. And then for about 10 years, just as a sports fan, I kept reading about it. And then slowly I made approaches to different journalists around 2017. And then from there I started working for some investigative teams. And since 2017, I've solely investigated doping in sports, really, doping in professional sports. And still to this day, everything that we learned in the Balco scandal in 2003 about the ways that athletes dope are still sort of pretty relevant today, actually.
Crazy how similar a bit it is between us, because for me it was cycling. I was a big I know that you are also a big cycling fan, but you mentioned track and field in the first place. For me, I was not so interested in track and field, but more in cycling. A lot of people in the 2000s and the early 2000s were very enthusiastic about cycling, obviously because of Jan Ullrich, the big German star. And funny enough, when I was young, very young, so let's say 9 to 14, when the 99 until 2005 Armstrong area was, I always was as a kid like, this guy has to be doped, and it's the poor Jan Ullrich. He has no chance against him. Obviously, we know today that everyone in the top field was doped with EPO, with blood doping, and also with other things. And Armstrong had probably the best doping techniques, the most professional doping environment we publicly know. So that was my experience to come into this topic. And then when I got older and I wanted to be a journalist, and I think it's totally the same with you, I tried to make the connections from this doping style to other sports because I followed a lot of sports, including tennis. And in this time, also in the early 2000s, there were a lot of South American tennis doping cases. We had Mariano Puerta, the first finalist, the first opponent in a French Open final from Rafa Nadal, got tested positive twice and in the end got suspended for 8 years. And I also followed tennis and then I thought, okay. And so that was our development. And to make it clear, you work not solely, but on a regular basis for the RD doping reduction. And you were also included in the newest, biggest documentation that came out a few days before the Olympics about the main thing in this documentation was that the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona also were orchestrated from the state to get a better result when it comes to doping. And the famous Spanish doping doctor, a gynecologist, Dr. Eufemanis Fuentes, was caught with hidden camera saying very decent things about how he did it back then already. In the shadows of the Spanish system to get a better result. And the last days with the Sinner case, you got a bit famous in the tennis circle as well, more famous as well, because of your great Substack, of your newsletter that you started. How long ago? Like 6 months, 7 months already?
So yeah, I started that in January. It's honestsport.com. And yeah, I publish twice a week a summary of all the latest sort of doping articles in the press and provide all of the URLs. But then on top of that, I publish longer investigative pieces, that may be 3,000 words. And yeah, it's gone very well. It's been really good feedback. And it's just great to have a place now where I can consistently write about a topic, which you just have so much more research sometimes than you have published. And obviously when you're your own editor, you can do what you want. And so it's really great. And yeah, I've got some good feedback from the anti-doping agencies. And yeah, and then since the Sinner case, I think the article had been read 800 times or something like that, which was published in May. And I think now it's over 30,000 times. And yeah, I can talk about that whenever we wish, really.
Yeah, we will come back to this in a few minutes. The article you mentioned was about the substance that Sinner was tested positive for and a lot of other Italian athletes in the time between 2019 and 2023 were caught or tested positive to this substance. We come later to that. But I highly recommend the newsletter, not because you're a friend of mine in the first place, but for the quality, what I consider you, like what you can do very, very well, and I don't know someone else that does this quite well, is this open source thing, researchers. What you can't imagine how much is publicly available about doping and tennis. And you do that so well, not only articles, social media, a lot of athletes that are very the opposite of careful when on social media, when they visit doctors, and sometimes they're not even aware of the things that they do at the hospital or at the clinic are forbidden under the water code and stuff like this. So I highly recommend On a Sport on Substack, and also your Twitter account, also On a Sport in German, Ehrlicher Sport, a very good name. So now that we are on the same page, we want to talk about doping and tennis. And I think for the classic advantage tennis podcast listeners, I talked about that a lot of times, but maybe we can just give 2-3 facts. And today I will push back a bit myself in the as an interviewer and give you this role to explain it, like to get really everyone on the same page, like why is tennis a good sport to dope?
Yeah, okay. Why is tennis a good sport to dope? I think it's better to sort of start with, at this point in professional sport, doping is embedded in all elite sport. Sure, it may be to varying degrees. Maybe it's more in cycling, maybe it's more in athletics, but it's firmly embedded at this point. You know, we had the state-run doping programs in the 70s and the 80s of in East Germany and the Soviet Union. And then in order for the US to keep up with these athletes who were, you know, raised taking anabolic steroids from the age of 12, obviously that meant that some US athletes then had to do that to compete. And there's been lots of, doping cases involving US athletes. And so it's only gone on from there. And obviously a sort of a big turning point was in doping becoming present in sort of the public's mind was the Lance Armstrong case. And that's sort of where when I first started looking into tennis, I went sort of to see sort of whether anyone had worked in tennis who'd also worked in cycling. And so I sort of built out that
Errani.
Yeah, sort of map or matrix, as you would say. So it wasn't just Armstrong's doctors. It was who in cycling was working also in tennis. And obviously Armstrong's doctor, Luis Garcia del Moral, worked in a tennis academy for 10 years. And he worked with, some of the top Spanish players in Valencia.
Valencia, right.
And also some of the Russian players. So Dinara Safina was one who he worked with. And everything that's in those sort of documents about the Armstrong case of taking EPO, taking human growth hormone, taking testosterone, and how you take it, when you take it, it obviously also applies to tennis, which is an endurance sport. Obviously, there's a high level of skill. But there's no reason why tennis players would not engage in this. And quite simply, if you just look through the 190 tennis cases that have been in history, we've had athletes who've tested positive for testosterone. We've had athletes who have been caught with human growth hormone. We've had one athlete recently who's been cleared of intent to cheat, but tested positive for a blood doping agent. And then if you look further, a lot of these cases are sometimes lower in the rankings, but they're still working, they're still competing in the same academies, with the same coaches, with the same doctors. And I always like to sort of say that doping isn't a bottom-up problem, it's a top-down problem. And what I mean from that is doping comes from elite-level sport with the best doctors, the best funds. That's where it was created, sort of how to dope and how to do it systematically. And then it just filters down into the lower levels, this knowledge, and they may do it in a less sophisticated way, but it's coming from the top. And so if you have doping cases at the bottom, but in tennis you have both, you have them at the bottom and at the top, but if you have more at the bottom sort of historically, then there must also be sort of undiscovered doping cases at the top. And I think with tennis, I've taken sort of a keen interest in the last sort of 10 years about it. Doping in tennis is because it's just become such a physical sport now. And, you know, these back-to-back five-set matches, why would sort of a tennis player not do it? We can get onto that later on, but sort of it's not so difficult to evade the testing system. And on top of that, we're now seeing sort of high-level players caught, particularly since the ITIA took over from the ITF, which is a independent anti-doping agency.
Yeah, thank you for your first comment on that. So there's a lot in it. If you see the change from ITF who did it, and then a few years ago they invented the ITIA. As you said, independent, but still founded financially also by the ATP and WTA and also the Grand Slams, the four Grand Slams and the ITF that have a lot of power. Still, and I said this publicly as well, I personally think that the ITIA does a bit of a better job than the ITF did before. They try their best. We had two famous cases in the last 2 years, the Sinner case now and the Halep case that started in 2022 with the positive test. And as you mentioned, a lot of smaller cases. But the ITIA also, and you see it in this case, has to deal with a lot of things when it comes to lawyers, to connections in between the cases, and it's very difficult. And as you mentioned already, tennis is a good sport for dope, not only for the tennis matches, but in generally, if you are more fit, you can practice more without getting injured. We have this in other sports as well. Players that see how much other players train, and then they try to increase their practice levels, and then they get injured because the body is not holding on and stuff like that. So there are many reasons to maybe go to the border on what is allowed and above that, because you see what other players are capable of, not at least at slams back to back to back, sometimes five set matches without players getting more tired, at least not visible. And so, yeah, that's why tennis is a good sport to dope. Obviously we had pre-talks before this podcast, and we talk on a regular doping on a regular basis about this topic. And what both of us amazes, because we are also we also love tennis and we follow the pro tour, obviously, me as a journalist, you when you were younger as a fan, and now also as a doping expert. You told me before, doping is part of the analysis of tennis, but most of the experts and analysers and journalists in this game are not talking about it or not consider how someone is good. Like, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so sort of the cycling world is now very well versed in doping because they've had to be. You know, if someone
because they
wins,
fucked up, yeah, because everything was public, yeah.
Yeah, of course. And journalists had to learn about it, and they had to follow it, and they had to ask tough questions about it. They had to write pieces about it, documentaries. And so what that's created now is the sort of the cycling journalism base, or fan base even, is more familiar with sort of the effects of doping. They question whether whether a cyclist is doping, and on top of that, quite simply, they understand sort of how important the physiology is in professional sport. And tennis is just sort of so far behind, because no players have ever wanted to speak about it. You know, the normal view is that there's no doping in tennis. And you never really have someone, when a case comes out, who says, "Oh, it's so sad, sort of what's happened. I feel like I've been cheated, or whatever."
We had this week for the first time, like on Twitter, players like Kyrgios and Luka Pui, for example, and Shapovalov, to name three, who didn't say that concrete, but they saw an unbalanced behavior, yeah?
No, yeah. So Kyrgios, yeah, said that. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the tennis fans, because the players don't talk about it, and the tennis journalists, they're not so versed in it. They're not familiar with it. And so I always think, sort of, if you spend all of this time analyzing the sport about who has the best forehand, whether they should play a backhand down the line on important points, if you're not talking about doping, which is such a, or at least, you know, just privately amongst friends, I understand it's a difficult thing to talk about publicly. If you're not sort of talking about that and the effect of that, and why, if a player is doing that, why they may be more likely to win, then you're leaving sort of a huge part of analysis on the table. And so I think in some ways, just not having no knowledge about it really decredibilizes sort of the analysts of some pundits and some journalists. Mm. They don't have to write about it, but at least just to sort of take more of an interest in it. And maybe now with these bigger cases in the last couple of years, you know, tennis will sort of, it will move on in that way, in the way that cycling has. But that's sort of what's always at the forefront of my mind when I think, has someone not considered that sort of, you know, some of these players are doping? You know, they're so fit, and doesn't mean they are, but if you want to write a story about how someone's improved physically for, you know, the last 3 years or something like that, it's so close to dope. You know, you improve physically to a point when you can't improve anymore, and then you have to resort to doping. And so there's just so much proximity in the topic. So basically, if you, yeah, that's why I think it's important to talk about it.
To back your opinions up, three things come to my mind when people talked about doping in the past in the tennis circle. For example, we have Jim Courier talking about it at the Australian Open 1999. So 1 year after the Festina scandal at the Tour de France in 1998. In January 1999, Jim Courier publicly said on a press conference that he was scared about some European players, how they do physically, and he knows his body, and he suggested or that probably European players would blood dope, etc. And a few days later, he had to talk with the ITF to explain why he said that publicly. 2011, Yannick Noah, the former French Open champion, suggested that or asked publicly why Spanish athletes and Spanish players could be so fit or more fit than other athletes, and got slammed publicly after from Rafa Nadal, Fernando Verdasco, and other players that it was bad behavior to talk about doping in that way and that it was a bad look for tennis. And Andy Murray, 2016, talked also about doping and that he asked for better tests, for more blood tests, etc. And basically, nothing happened in that regard. Now we got a bit more blood tests as well, not on the level we both would wish for. And there's a lot to do, but there is a bit of an increase. And what we saw this
I think
week,
just,
no, go ahead.
yeah, I think just to advance your point there a bit, I think when these players have spoken out, you know, Jim Courier talking out 20, 25 years ago now, it's always concerning to me when sort of tennis players say, "Oh, I can put my hand on the fire for sort of 99% of players. This player isn't the, and there's no way that my rivals are there. There's no my rivals are cheating." Because there's not that much testing in tennis, or there hasn't been historically, at least. Maybe, yeah, sure, there is more in recent years, but a long time ago, it's sort of there's no testing, and then you have players who don't want to talk about it when it's obviously embedded in professional sport, and so it becomes, you're like, well, why don't players want to talk about really what is the prevalence of this? And yeah, so generally, just the, yeah, the prevalence is sort of to be determined, but just to bring up a recent study. So in 2022, across British sport, not just tennis, or just, yeah, just across the whole of British sport, there was an anonymous survey that was put to about 800 British athletes, and they were asked, there's ways of the way the survey is designed, there's way to anonymize them so they
Yes.
feel comfortable
Very complicated, but yeah.
answering these sort of socially undesirable questions. And 13% admitted to having doped in the last, you know, in the last 12 months. And it would
Just
be interesting
like
to see if,
stop
you
at
know,
this
if the
point,
ITIA wanted
Edmund. Stop at this
to do
point,
one of
but
these
it's
studies.
stop at this point because it's very important to understand because it goes so quick on the podcast stats. 13% of these 800 athletes. So that's a huge percentage number in my opinion and in your opinion as well. Just
Yeah.
to get that in your minds, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you think 13% is 13 of the top 100, you know, if tennis had a similar prevalence. But what would be interesting to see is if the, you know, these studies now can be rolled out very quickly. The World Anti-Doping Agency has a prevalence working group to establish the prevalence of doping in sports. And so, quite simply, you know, if the ITIF wanted to, or the ITIA, I don't know who would be responsible for that. They could run this out at the all four Grand Slams, and you get a good idea of what the prevalence is. Yeah, and that would, yeah, it's important, obviously. It's why they've set up the group at the World Anti-Doping Agency.
So the one problem is that normally a few people in a tennis circle talk about doping, about the problem on a regular basis. I was slammed also. I do it on a regular basis. I not only have fans in the tennis community that I talk and write about it. And now when big cases arise like this week, suddenly everyone wants to talk about doping and consider themselves as experts. We saw this week. Maybe before we start with the Sinner case, one last thing. The people that follow my social media saw a big argument this week with Andy Roddick. I did a thread. You did threads in the past so many times about that topic. And I did it that I quoted him from his podcast, who basically, Andy Roddick in his newest episode said, there's no chance that you could possibly doping when you get tested at slams the way Jannik Sinner was tested before and during the Australian Open. And I tried to make the point that just only because you get a drug tested at tournaments or regular doesn't mean there are no dopers out. And he answered and said he was regularly tested, also out of competition and without knowledge, around 40 times in the year he got number one, 2003. And then I fact-checked the thing and confronted him with him, and we had a back and forth. And it got on the level that more than 200,000 people on Twitter saw it, which is a good thing for the topic. But it was also very difficult because he has more than 1.7 million followers. So you can also get slammed very easily without doing anything wrong. But I think it's important to bring the topic on the map as you do it on a regular basis.
I guess on that note, about sort of the testing program, and you know, lots of players say, oh, you know, we have to give a time slot where we are every day for 1 hour of the year. We're tested X number of times a year, and therefore we can't dope. If you actually break it down, there are lots of avenues in which you can dope and get around the testing system. And I think just to explain a bit about how it works in tennis is, or in all sports, but in tennis, the off season is from mid-November until early January. And however good a anti-doping program is, or a testing program is, you're always going to be tested less outside of competition. And in tennis, the sort of concerning period for anti-doping agencies is that 6 weeks, basically, because you can go off and fly to somewhere where you aren't normally, and so you're not going to be tested as often there. And it's in those 6 weeks when players, again, to talk about the juxtaposition, how the proximity of topics of physicality and doping, those 6 weeks is when players go to improve their physicality and build their physical base for the rest of the year. And that's when they're more likely to do it. And there was a Victor Conte, who was, as I mentioned earlier, the Balco chemist. Yes. He says, at this point, most of the out-of-competition testing in all sports should be during this out-of-competition period. And so in tennis, that's where you would look at. It's those 6 weeks. And then a player can say, oh, I've been tested 20 times this season. Yeah, but how many times were they tested randomly out of competition in those 6 weeks?
That's the main point.
And yeah, and then the last thing is, which is sort of the big problem in the system, is the tests are never totally random, right? Because you have to put this slot of where you are 1 hour a day, so you always know which time it's going to be. And the testers can come at any other point in that day, and then it will be truly random. But even for these out-of-competition tests, when they come in your one-hour time slot, not totally random, mm-hmm. basically. But the day is random, but the time isn't.
Mm-hmm. Also, directly at this point, a very important thing is, for example, as a German tennis journalist, or a journalist that focused a lot on tennis, I talked with a lot of German pro tennis players about their testing. Yeah, Jan-Lennard Struff, Dominik Köpfer, and other players. And they say basically they're happy to get tested a lot of times, also without notice, also in the morning. For example, players get tested at 6:30 a.m., getting ring belt at their own door. Maybe the kids wake up by that. They don't complain so much. They say it's okay to get that, as long as other players from all other countries get the same treatment. And I think this is a problem that we both looked into in the past. For example, the Spanish anti-doping authorities, the Spanish anti-doping agency, had a lot of problems. Maybe this is a note you can talk about it.
Yeah, so as you know well, through speaking to German players, so in Germany, you have an out-of-competition testing program through the German anti-doping agency.
Yes.
And Germany, I think, is the best, actually, by quite some distance. Because I went through the statistics, I don't know, some time back. But in the Spanish anti-doping agency, at least some years, they don't have any out-of-competition testing. So they basically leave the majority of the testing up to the ITIF or the ITIA, which it is now. So, as you say, some players are subjected to more stringent testing. At the same time, I don't think we've ever really had a doping case that's been prosecuted outside of the ITIF or the ITIA.
I'm not sure who took the test.
Even the NADAs aren't doing so great.
For example, I'm not quite sure who took the test in 2021, but I know, for example, with the Diana Jastremska case, she was tested positive in September or November 2020, and that was an out-of-competition test at home during practice in the Ukraine before the war starts. So, and she was tested positive, later cleared with an explanation I'm not allowed to talk about anymore. She continues to play, but that was an out-of-competition test. So I don't know if it was the Ukrainian anti-doping authorities or the ITF. I have to look
it up. I would imagine it was the ITF. Yeah.
But the most important thing that you should keep in mind, out-of-competition testing is very important without notice at home when you practice and not know that they are coming. And there are rumors out that in certain countries, this is not common sense, and sometimes even players get notes before or calls before that someone probably comes to test you. And we all know as experts that you can prepare yourself when you know that you will be drug tested to get a clean result. We talk now for more than 35 minutes about doping in general, but I think it's important to get everyone. Do you want to add something?
No, I was going to say, we've got to make sure we don't talk for 3 hours today.
Yeah, that's our topic. But we want to come to the Sinner case now, and I make sure that I give you notes in the chapters. If you want, just listen to the case, then you can start now. But I think for a lot of people out there, it was important and also interesting to talk about it in general. And we didn't even mention a lot of statistics in tennis, like 103 tennis players failed doping cases, and that in 2018, 72% of players who were caught with drugs in tennis in their system were not punished, 72% of positive tested players. And the same year, 2018, the International Tennis Federation reduced blood doping tests by 40%. If you want to read more about these topics, you can go on Edmund's Substack on a sport. He has a lot of long reads about doping and tennis in general. So now we arrived finally to the case of Jannik Sinner, and also to have everyone on the same style of information, I will shortly read a short summary now about the case, and then we start talking about it, obviously. So, Sinner tested positive for the steroid clozapine, which is on the World Anti-Doping Agency's WADA banned list, in two doping tests on March 10th, an in-competition test at a tournament in Indian Wells, and on 18 March an out of competition test this year in 2024. Sinner was then informed, as usual, by the International Tennis Integrity Agency, ITIA. We talked about the ITIA a lot, which is responsible for handling and investigating doping cases in tennis, and was immediately provisionally suspended. Main proceedings were initiated. Sinner had 10 days time to lift that provisional suspension. That is really important. Sinner and his legal team immediately, actually on the same day they were informed, took legal actions against this provisional suspension and pleading for contamination. To the contamination we come later, obviously. The provisional suspension was lifted, so they were successful, and the player was allowed to continue playing while the ITIA investigations in the background until the final hearing started. So that was also the only reason why he was allowed to continue to play and why the case wasn't made public at that time. There has been vocal criticism from the tennis world that, unlike in other cases, Sinner was allowed to continue playing during the investigation, and that the case has only now become public. Unlike in the case of Simona Halep and most other prominent cases, Sinner won his appeal against the provisional ban. The legal team of the industry leader responded twice on the day the test result was announced and won. And again, this was the only reason the case remained secret. An ITIA spokesperson we both talked to and I talked to this week for two written pieces I published said the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has no precise rules for such provisional suspensions, but has approved this procedure in this special Sinner case. The appeal was successful. Sinner's provisional suspension was lifted. The 23-year-old was allowed to continue playing in April and finished first in the world rankings during the French Open. In the background, he and his team were questioned several times by the ITIA, and the main proceedings were prepared. After the hearing on August 15, so 10 days ago, the ITIA made the case and the outcome public this week on August 21, so 4 days ago. An independent tribunal of the London-based organization Sport Resolution, convened by the ITIA, had found no fault or negligence on the part of Sinner. After consulting with scientific experts who considered Sinner's explanation to be credible, the ITIA did not argue against Sinner's explanation in the main proceedings. Sinner was not banned and will be allowed to compete in the US Open that starts tomorrow on Monday. Very complicated for people that not follow doping cases on a regular basis. That's why it was important to me to read it. And before we start, did I forget anything, or is anything important in general?
No, that's the summary of the facts. Yeah, I think that's everything.
Perfect. Then I think the first or the most important thing that we should talk about first is the contamination. According to the 33-page ITIA report, which we both read, and I think a lot of tennis fans on Twitter also try to read and understand, because there are a lot of opinions on Twitter right now. According to this report, Sinner's fitness coach Umberto Ferrara had purchased the medical spray Trofodermin, which contains the substance Clostebol, over the counter at the pharmacy in Bologna in February, so 1 month earlier to the positive test. What you have to understand is that in Italy, you can get Clostebol or Trofodermin without a recipe over the counter at the pharmacy. For example, in Germany, it's forbidden. It's also forbidden in Great Britain, Ed?
Yeah, so just on that point, Clostebol is an anabolic steroid that was produced by an East German company,
yes,
in the 60s, and also an Italian company called Farm Italia, and it was used more then as sort of an injection, as like a stronger anabolic, a stronger preparation of the steroid. But it's not really available now. Even if you look on the black market, it's not really available. People don't talk about it on bodybuilding forums, and so as a doping agent, or as anything, it seems to only be available now really in these sort of ointments, sprays or creams, and they are only really sold in Italy mainly, Brazil, and I think the Dominican Republic.
Good. Thanks for the
so
note.
That's why you're able to buy it over the counter.
Yeah.
But you're not able to buy it over the counter as like an injectable anabolic steroid like testosterone. It's part of this sort of wound treatment.
Yes.
But it still has some anabolic properties because it has clostapol in it.
Yeah. So it's important to note that he bought it in a pharmacy in Bologna in February and had a receipt for it. It is not clear from the report why he bought this spray in the first place. So that was not mentioned in the hearing. During the tournament in Indian Wells at the beginning of March, so 1 month later, he had kept the truck in his personal belongings. And on March the 3rd, Sinner's physiotherapist Naldi cut his finger with a scalpel used to treat calluses on the player's feet and wore then a bandage for 2 days on his fingers. After the removal, the fitness trainer, Ferrara, is said to have advised Naldi to spray this trofodermine on the cut for faster healing and antiseptic properties, which he did, which he said he did. Naldi used the spray from March 5th to March 13th, during which time he performed daily full body massages on Sinner and changed bandage on his feet as well. He did not wear clothes. The substance had been transferred in very small doses, the report says. On the day of the first positive doping sample on March 10, he had sprayed his finger twice before Sinner's treatment. And in his hearing, he said he could not remember washing his hands beforehand. After questioning Sinner twice, the ITIA accepted that Sinner did not know that his fitness trainer was in possession of trofodermine, that Sinner had not known that the drug contained a banned substance, and that Sinner did not know that his physiotherapist had used the drug. Yes, so that was the explanation of the contamination, and now we should be all on the same page. We both agreed beforehand that one of the most important questions is why the fitness trainer bought it in February in the first place. And now we are on your report about clostebol in general with Italian athletes. So it's your turn.
Yeah, I guess. I will start a little about. Yeah, I'll just give a few comments on the case. So this has gone to an independent tribunal, and that's the ITIA presents their case and Sinner's team presents their case, and there's an arbitrator who will come to a decision. But I think a important point of context here is that before arbitration, and a summary of the facts was agreed by both sides, Sinner's side and the ITIA, mm-hmm. and they agreed that this was a contamination case. So it was agreed, this narrative of events.
And why do you think that the ITIA agreed on that beforehand?
Because I think it's on paragraph 32. There's an agreed summary of facts. It says that both sides have agreed on a summary of facts. And in that summary of facts, it's everything you've explained about this cut and so on. And so at the arbitration, it was actually more discussing whether Sinner would be found to have been at no fault or negligence. And if they couldn't have found that, then he would have been sanctioned, not because he'd intended to cheat, but because, he'd acted negligently. And so a lot of the discussion was about that. And a lot of discussion centered around whether Sinner's team counted as him. And so and therefore whether if they were acted negligently, whether he had also acted negligently. Anyway, obviously Sinner said it's a mistake what his team did, but the tribunal found that Sinner hadn't done anything wrong. And so I just think that's an important point of context in that this wasn't the ITIA coming in saying, hey, this guy's cheated, and the evidence they were putting forth wasn't that. They weren't talking about why They probably did this in their previous investigations after the positive, but before and before they'd agreed on the facts. But they, so it's not discussed in the hearing what in the decision why this Umberto Ferrara, why he bought the Trofoderm initially in Bologna, which has a warning sign on it. It didn't discuss at length of that negligence that when he first bought it with the doping sign on and then brought it to the US. So that's also interesting. But then lastly, I would just explain that whichever way you want to start from, if you want to start that Sinner's innocent, of course, Sinner's series story of events makes sense. And then if you want to be more critical, then there are obviously gaps in there are some inconsistencies. And what the main one being so when the physical trainer passed the spray onto the physio, who then used it on his cut and massaged Sinner, he said that he told the physio about that it contained a doping substance. And this physio said that I believe he says he couldn't remember. And so that was a slight inconsistency there, but the arbitrator found to trust Ferrara's version of events and that he had told him.
If I could step
Yeah, so
in
th
at
those are
this
sort of my
topic.
main sort of talk thoughts on the immediate having sort of read through the decision.
This is a very important point, but because, for example, Darren Cahill, Sinner's tennis trainer and former trainer of Simona Halep and, for example, Andre Agassi, he was doing TV interviews at the US Open this week, and he was asked in one of the interviews about Sinner's main reason for his improvement a few months ago. And in this, he said, two words, Umberto Ferrara, the physical trainer, he's been a genius in what he's been able to do. Yes. You wrote about Italian athletes between 2019 and 2023 that had problems and were tested positive for Clostebol, including tennis players. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I yeah, as part of my research, just generally across doping in sports, I sort of keep up to date with the recent doping cases, and we started to see some in Italian tennis, and this was actually sort of what led me down that route to look into it in tennis is so this just to let everyone know, this was published in May and I probably started this in 2023, this investigation, so long before the Sinner case. And that I'd realized there'd been four, I think actually when I'd begun, there'd only been two Clostebol cases in it by Italian players amongst two 17 year olds in 2021. And then as I was doing it more, as I was investigating more, I think we had the another case at the end of 2022, maybe, or the end of, or the beginning of 2023, and then we had another case, and I was like, oh, okay, all right, well, there's really something going on here. And then obviously we've had the Sinner case now, but before that, basically, what I started looking into is why are Italian tennis players and Italian sports people in general testing positive for Clostebol? And why is it seemingly happening most of the time in Italy? And I looked up, there's been 38 positive Clostebol tests at least since 2019. You can read the article on my Substack, but I believe that's the stat. And it's
38.
over 50% of cases come from Italy. And I was sort of like, well, obviously with all doping cases, when you have this many doping cases, they are obviously not all unintentional. And they are coming from Italy. So I started to ask people, few contacts, what do you think's going on? I spoke to one, the former head of the Portuguese anti-doping agency called Luis Horta, who's quoted in the article, and he said, yes, Edmund, I had some Clostebol cases when I was in Brazil, because he was also in Brazil. And he said, yeah, I started to believe that these were doping cases. And he said, I think they're using it as creams. Some of these athletes are using them as creams or gels, in a way that testosterone creams and gels have been used for many years as part of wider doping program. And then I looked into, well, maybe they're testing positive for clostebol. Maybe some people are injecting it. But as I said earlier, it didn't seem to be available anywhere else from Italy, other than Italy. And so it's now available as this sort of cream or spray in Italy. And it has a warning on the box, a red warning, doping crossed through, saying, don't take this. It basically said, don't take it. It has doping in it, doping substances in it. And so I was like, okay, well, yeah, and spoke to a few more sources. It was like, yeah, it seems like it could be used as creams. And then there were some more suspicious cases I found linked to quite a dodgy doctor who I didn't name in the article. And then I looked into sort of how are these testosterone gels used, basically. And so if you look in sort of the Lance Armstrong documents, what he would do is sort of in the off season, he would take his wider doping program when he wasn't available for testing. So he would take EPO, human growth hormone, insulin, maybe a small anabolic steroid. But then when it was closer to race time, he would start to take, testosterone gels or testosterone sprays. And he would do that sort of recovery after races. So if you have low testosterone, your body's going to be more inflamed after a big sort of cycling effort. And so they'd rub in testosterone into whatever their thigh, or Armstrong even had it in a spray form in olive oil that he got from his doctor, Michele Ferrari, who's now been banned for life. And he would spray it under the tongue, and that would help with his dampen his inflation and help his recovery. And so it's not like it's this, that's the main part of a doping program. This is really for recovery at this stage. So anyone taking clostebol is not doing it to put on a huge amount of muscle. There's better anabolic steroids for that. Mm-hmm. Stenozolol, boldenone that you would take out of competition, but they take longer to clear the system. Whereas with clostebol and testosterone gels, they clear the system, at least testosterone gels, we know because we have more sort of evidence on it. They clear the system very, very quickly. And so there was even in 2013, there was a baseball player, very famous. I think he played for the New York Yankees, maybe, Alex Rodriguez. And he used to take testosterone creams on the day of a match. And clostebol, yeah, tell me when to, if you want me to break up. And stop and
no, yeah, no, it's very interesting, but maybe I ask you two questions because that are the main character questions this week, because it's very important. If you get long answers, there are so much important things, but I think the listeners should now listen very closely because two questions which you try to answer at the moment. First, how quick this substance is out of the body? And second, that's the argument of Sinner fans and people that that believe him 100% say he was only tested with a very, very micro doses of this substance. These are the two questions which you elaborate at the moment on.
Yeah. So I guess I'll just, rather than to refer to Sinner's case, I'll just refer to the case of, I think he's called Stefano Bartolino. And he tested positive in late 2023 at a tournament in Morocco. And he was found to have intended to cheat by the same sort of level of proof in a tribunal. And he was banned for 4 years. So there are players officially, tennis players unofficially. There is one player in Italy, tennis player, taking clostebol officially as a doping agent. And the reason why they take it is because it clears the system so fast. And so when you have very low levels and if you are running an organized doping program, you are planning for when the testers are going to come and you are planning to be tested when the drugs are no longer in your system.
In general speaking, not in the case of Sinner, but in general speaking, for legal reasons.
And when you have these low levels, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is what you would expect. If someone is cheating, you would expect it to be almost zero or extremely low levels, unless they were caught, you know, really unexpected.
And that's very important to understand, because I also said it multiple times, and Edmund also fights for this because it's very important. If someone who allegedly intends to dope on purpose and then gets tested positive, the explanation in social media or in official statements are always the same. Yeah, it could not possibly be on purpose or for a better match or something, because it was only so small what they found.
Yeah, and so these experts say, you can get an expert who will say, this low level is consistent with contamination. And obviously, someone is going to use that in their favor who wants to escape punishment. But it is also consistent with, quite simply, you took a higher dose, and over days, as it's cleared your system, the amount detectable in your system has gone down until ultimately it tends to zero. And that is often the case when an athlete who is doping gets caught. And the amount found in their system is not performance enhancing if it had been taken at that dose. But if it had been taken at a higher dose, and it's simply at low levels now because they took it a while ago, the initial dose was performance enhancing. And that is just one of the key points to take into account. Obviously, if someone tests positive for a huge amount of Clostobol, then of course they've intended to cheat. But it's more nuanced than just low levels. And yeah, that's that. And your other question was, sorry?
No, you explained both questions. First, why it's always low levels, and you can't explain that this is the reason why an athlete didn't intend to dope. And the second question was the reference to how quick the substance can go out of the body. And for example, Nikirios retweeted a stat or a study that says it can clear the system within 49 hours. Maybe you can say something about that as well.
Yeah, so Nick Kyrgios came out and he said something. I think there was a quote from someone saying that when you're tested, if you're tested, then you can't. If you're tested and you're clean, then and it comes. Sorry, if you're tested and it comes back negative, then you're clean. And he said, "You've got no idea what you're talking about. Players can take testosterone gummies, whatever." And he got a community note on Twitter, and I think in the community note, it spelled Clostobol wrong as Clobestol.
Yes.
And it said that it took 31 days to clear the system. But if you look at different studies, so there's one study that came out in 2020, which is a bit different because it was assessing if someone could, like in the Sinner case, if someone could contaminate you by having it on their hand, and they found that that is possible. And so they did an experiment where everyone shook each other's hand, basically. But in some of those cases, even though it was low levels being passed on, they cleared the system in 49 hours in one of the cases. And I think always what's important to take into account is, even in these scientific studies, you're not mirroring the way an athlete who is doping would be taking the substance. So if I go and shake some, if I'm a part of this study, and they just give me a bit of Clostobol, it's not going to cause me any health problems, and they test me to see if it's still detectable after an hour, and I'm, you know, sitting down eating a cheeseburger in that time. It's very different. One of the world's best athletes, or any top-level athlete, taking it, doing exhaustive exercise, maybe taking it with something else, so it's going to clear their body quicker. And then quite simply, maybe when you have a doping control, you drink lots of water to dilute the urine even more, to bring that to increase how quickly it leaves the system. Then it could be even less than that. And obviously we haven't had a whistleblower yet who's spoken about how Clostobol creams are taken, but we can just say that there are too many cases for Clostobol to not be these creams to are not being taken in some way. And
Certainly.
here I wanted to refer to the recent Russian doping scandal. So Russia ran a state-run doping program, you know, for London 2012. The reports were about London 2012 and the Sochi Winter Olympics. And the main orchestrator of that, not orchestrator, but the main doping doctor was Grigory Rodchenkov, who is in the Icarus. He's the main character in the Icarus documentary that won an Oscar on Netflix.
Yes.
And he created a doping cocktail called the Duchess cocktail. Mm-hmm. And that contained orotrabrinibol, which is an anabolic steroid. I think it contained oxandrolone, and it contained another steroid that I don't recall. And that was dissolved in vermouth or whiskey. Maybe they're the same thing. No, they're not. So it's either dissolved in vermouth or whiskey. And then the athletes would put it in their mouth. They would swill it around their mouth after training, and then they would spit it. They would spit it out. And orotrabrinibol has for a long time thought to have been extremely detectable because it's been used since the East German times. But here we were in 2012, and you had, or 2014, and you had these athletes taking this drug, and because it was being swirled around in their mouth, it was giving them some performance enhancing benefit, but it wasn't metabolizing fully in the body. And so we don't know with these clostebol creams whether they're being taken with something else, whether a spray is being taken with alcohol and it's being rubbed, it's being put in the mouth, like swished around the mouth, like in the retrain. We just don't know. All we just know is there are so many cases, and there are athletes who have been caught and haven't had a reduction in their sanction. And so, just to go back, these studies of the clearance from the body are not. They obviously have they have scientific basis because they're being analyzed using the same techniques, but that the people being analyzed aren't mirrored. They're just not the same as an athlete, a top level athlete who is doping, who is doing it with more knowledge and expertise. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for that long explanation. Very, very well. To get the connection back to the Sinner case, I think I made a small mistake 10 minutes ago when I was talking about Darren Cahill. I said he was doing TV interviews this week at the US Open, which he did. But the quote I said was a few months ago. Darren Cahill was asked in an interview about Sinner's main reason for his improvement a few months ago, not this week. And then he said two words: Umberto Ferraro, the physical trainer, he's been a genius in what he's been able to do. So that guy who bought their substance in the Farmacia in February in Bologna. And what I want to refer to now, Ed, is Cahill did interviews this week, a few days ago, where he said he doesn't know yet if the physio and the fitness trainer will return to the team of Jannik Sinner. Now, on Sunday, the 25th of August, we know that Jannik Sinner stopped working with both of them. He kicked them out of his team because of trust issues that he mentioned on his public press conference on Media Day at the US Open. And we asked the question why the fitness trainer bought it in the pharmacy in February in the first place. Could there be a punishment for Sinner or for the fitness coach or for both of them in combination for owning the substance during a tournament?
Yeah, I guess, initially what's interesting is that they've been fired now. Obviously, this case has been known about for a long time.
They're fired week, not when Sinner knew about the case.
I believe they've been fired this week. I'm not familiar with whether they were at other tournaments recently, but I think they've been fired this week. And I think he found out in April. So it's interesting that he's waited until this time to fire them when
good point.
This fault was committed in early April. Yes. And then your question was?
the question was, could there be a punishment for the fitness coach or for Sinner or for both of them just because he had their, it's so much information. I have to look it up. What was the name of the...
Frank Verdermann.
Yes. Could there be a punishment by ITIA or by WADA just for having it in the bag as a forbidden substance during a tennis tournament?
So at this point, it would be very unlikely. But in the WADA code, you're not allowed to possess a banned substance.
Yeah, that's why I asked. Yes.
If it is for an athlete, so obviously, in Sinner's case, that the ITIA found that wasn't the case. But initially, they probably would have asked him, "What in the initial investigations? Why did you initially buy this in March?" Because he had a bank record of buying this in March. I don't know whether they asked for bank records.
February.
In February. Yeah.
No problem. It's complicated.
I don't know whether they asked for more bank records as to whether he'd bought it on other occasions. Obviously, it would have been good for transparency if that could have been disclosed as to why that had been bought. But yeah, in some scenarios, if an anti-doping agency suspects that you have bought a substance for doping purposes, then that is something that they could prosecute. But that's obviously been decided that wasn't the case because the ITIA, they agreed on the contamination.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Later on, I want to talk a bit about the legal side of this case, but the next thing that comes to my mind is the three medical experts that were asked about this case. You can read it in the ITIA report on the 33 pages. I will also put it in the notes of this podcast. It's public, so if someone wants a good night read, you can have one. It is said that two of the three experts didn't know the name of the player, and which means one of them knew when they were reviewing the case that it was Jannik Sinner. What do you think about that?
I don't think that's so relevant, to be honest, because they knew that they were... They knew that they were going to have their names published in the decision. I don't think it's so relevant, really. It's that's done for the athlete biological passport. So when there's an ABP case, it should be anonymized initially. Mm-hmm. I think in this case you can. I don't think it changes too much. You know, the positive is already there, whereas with the athlete, the positive is already there basically. So I think. Yeah, the main thing about that is we haven't seen everything that experts said. You know, obviously we've just seen, you wouldn't expect that in a normal case, but we've only seen a few, you know, snippets from what the experts have said.
People that are not into doping cases on a regular basis are, if you confront them with cases and explanations about contaminations, they are always... what's the best English word for it? Sometimes they even laugh about it because it sounds so complicated and not normal, these whole explanations. And every time I read it, even though I'm into this topic, I always smile because it seems so complicated or so. And there are always things that I don't understand. If you are a professional athlete and you have professional people around you, like a fitness trainer and a physio, simple things as if I cut my finger and treat myself with something and I have to do massages, why don't wear clothes? Why don't communicate about the supplement? Why don't communicate with the player? Why don't wash your hands?
Yeah.
So what I actually want to ask you, does it have to be that complicated so that it can be explained? Or, do you believe this kind of explanations?
Yeah, so generally, fans or readers, I can even see sort of through the statistics of my own website, they love to read about surprising doping excuses, basically. And then we've had quite a few recently. You know, some of the Klosterboll ones are involving, you know, athletes' dogs. You know, only last week, a Polish canoeist, who competed at in the Paris Olympics, she was cleared after she'd given Klosterboll cream or to her dog to treat a wound on her dog. There may have not been a warning sign on that ointment because it was for a dog, so it may not have had the same doping warning sign. But I looked her up immediately on social media, and she was training in Italy at the time. So that's just from last week, basically. So you have one of these. So it seems that it's, you know, when you read all of these excuses, cases as a whole, not individually, that it's very difficult to not accidentally test positive. And Patrick Mouratoglou, Serena Williams's coach, and Simona Halep's coach said the other week, in the majority of cases, athletes are innocent when they test positive. I would like to say how it is not that difficult to never test positive. So there you have about you have the world's best team who you thank after every match, after every competition, football, tennis, whatever, always about the team. Thank my doctors, thank my physical trainers. We're the most professional team in the world. We've got the most money in the world. But then when it comes to administrative stuff, sometimes we just make the most sort of basic mistakes. And to sort of just go a bit more sort of technical on that, when an athlete takes a supplement, there's a website called Informed Sport or Global Dro, where basically you can just check that the substance, for no extra cost, you can check that the substance that you've taken, the supplement that you're taking has no. It's been tested. It doesn't have any contaminants in, and that's for nutritional supplements. And then on your doping control form, there is a box. What have you taken in the last 7 days? And you always put everything that you've taken down, because then when you test positive, if you are an unfortunate person who has genuinely tested positive, you just go straight to those supplements and you go, okay, well, I took this. And then maybe you have the batch retested and you got really, really, really unlucky. And informed, I don't know an informed sport case where there's been where the supplements have been contaminated. And then quite simply, everything that you take, you check. If there's a doping warning on a trophoderm box, don't bring it with you to a tournament. You know, sure, it can be immediately for you, but at least you know, handle this like a hot cold, you know, around your athlete. And it's just not that difficult to not test positive, you know. Because
Yeah, good
why
point.
should why would it be? Otherwise you would have these, you know, then the anti-doping system should sort of like be collapsed. If every time an elite athlete, which is the majority of cases, if every time an elite athlete is getting caught and it's because of contamination, then it is doing more damage than good. And if you look at some of the statistics of from the ITF from between 2013 and 2020, and the number of cases that have been dropped, I think 33% of positives between 2013 and 2020 led to anti-doping rule violations, of which those 33%, lots were they would have been cleared of an intent to cheat. So if tennis really wants to have this conversation, or sport in general, of where this is just so bad, you know, sort of our top players are getting caught because of this simple stuff, then the anti-doping system is doing more harm than good, and then it really needs immediate reform. If you want to take these cases as a whole and say that's the conclusion that we're going to come to, not taking them individually, then that's an opinion you have to have, and you need to act on that then. And tennis should, you know, have much worse testing or have much higher threshold limits so people can accidentally test positive for more stuff more often. And it's not difficult.
It gets difficult when you see how much money is in pro tennis, how much money the best players in the world earn, how much people participate on pro tennis, sponsors, sport politics people, ATP, WTA, the ITF, especially the Grand Slams. We all know how much money they make with the Slams. And if there's a real intent to fight against the doping problem, or even to acknowledge that there is a real doping problem, and you see who is always giving public statements after cases in the tennis world. Just one example, Mats Wilander this week said there's no chance that this could be a real doping case because it's such a small substance. We talked about it, but Mats Wilander back in the days had also problems with doping with a normal truck, if you want to say one or two phrases about it.
About the Wilander case?
Huh?
About the Wilander case?
Yes.
Yeah? Well, no, but I think that's not the first time. When he comes out, he normally always says, you know, the person is innocent. So
yes,
just pick the next name from a box and I'm sure he'll say the next person.
Yeah, that's what I want to say, you know. Case. It's always the same narrative. Yeah. And in my opinion, yeah, or in our opinion, the wrong narrative. But they try to save the game and just everything continues, especially before a slam.
I think also recently in tennis, there's now been this sort of talk about how the process is wrong, what's being followed. And I would just like to sort of say the way the Halep case was dealt with and the way that the Sinner case was dealt with, one, have been totally by the book. In different ways, sure, but as in Sinner had the right to appeal his provisional suspension, and that doesn't happen often, but he had the right to do it. He had an explanation immediately. And in the Halep case, it went on and on about sort of how long it had taken, but it was a complicated case. It was an athlete biological passport case that was ultimately cleared on appeal. And yeah, she had to wait on the sidelines for some time, but you know, this is what happens in sort of doping cases. They're dealt with in sort of 6 to 12 months. And I saw yesterday Djokovic, or last night, he gave a comment about, it was quite hard to understand his recent comment, but he was saying how sort of, oh, the protocols need to change because the cases are being dealt with differently.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, then you need to make a change to the regulations. But one point I wanted to make there is that the protocols in tennis have improved. So before, provisional suspensions weren't announced. So before 2016, you didn't have provisional suspensions being announced.
Good point.
And if a player then went on to be cleared, the case would not be announced. And in 2016, there were 19 cases. So there are 19 of these cases, the Sinner case we now know, but in 2016, there were 19 players who were charged with an anti-doping rule violation. They were suspended. The public didn't know about it. And they were cleared in those 19 cases. And we do not know the identity of those players.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since 2016, these provisional suspensions are announced. These protocols are actually, what Djokovic is saying, the protocols have actually been improved since then, because we won't have now 19 cases of an athlete being provisionally, of a tennis player being provisionally suspended and the public not knowing about it. You will just have the odd occasional case, like in Sinner's, where they appeal the provisional suspension and therefore it doesn't become public. So the protocols in tennis have improved. And
good point.
Yeah, so it's in a better position now. Sure, that means you're going to have more doping cases in the public, which brings its own problems, but...
Very important point. People are confused because it's so complicated. Doesn't mean it's wrong. But it's complicated for people that are not talking or researching about it on a daily basis. Just to complete, I also don't want to talk about Wilander. It was about cocaine, but just to get that straight. But that's not the point. But what you did a good quote there, because now in the later stages of this podcast, we want to talk about the legal side of the procedure. And it was a good comment for you to say it was correct, but it's complicated. And a few things within this process are difficult to process for people, and also some things don't give a good look on it either. As we prepared for this podcast, for one last time, it's necessary to read a few things about that so that I don't get it wrong about the legal side. As we know, there has been vocal criticism from the tennis world that, unlike in other cases, Sinner was allowed to continue playing during the investigation and that the case has only now become public. Unlike in the cases of Simona Halep and most other prominent cases, Sinner won his appeal against the provisional ban. The legal team of the industry leader responded twice. On the day they got the note, we talked about that in the beginning of the podcast, but this is a point a lot of people don't understand. Yes, it was according to the rules, but not everyone can have enough money and enough experts around to do it on the same day you get the note. And even within the 10 days, you have time. For example, Tara Moore, the British player, she didn't appeal the provisional suspension and then waited 19 months until the outcome of the official hearing. You have the number one who has such a big team, including lawyers, that can handle this within hours, and also public relation agents that can spin around everything and talk to people we don't know, obviously. I asked the ITIA, I don't know if you did it as well, but I asked if there's a chance that Sinner and his team maybe got a note before the day they were told that he was tested positive. Obviously, I was told no. But still, to, and you talk about this so often, to be able to finish legal procedures and to send it to lift your provisional suspension within one day, within hours, blows my mind. Or do you say, No, it's if you have enough money and have enough lawyer, it's very, you can be capable of doing that.
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, when you hear that and you think, oh, they were able to respond in a day, when you know how careful people are with legal cases and so on, you would think it's surprising that that's happened in one day. And so people have asked, oh, whether they've been informed about it before. But I think what's interesting about the Trofoderming cases, so if you take two Trofoderming cases and you have an athlete who is doping, mm-hmm. and you have an athlete who is not doping, but if the substance has been bought by their team, in the case of Sinner, it's been bought by their team. In both of these cases, you are buying the substances. You have a bank record of the substances, unless you've paid in cash.
Yes.
And the doper knows that he's taken it and that he's doping, and he knows about these previous cases and what the defense is. The non-doper's bought it, but if he has a problem from accidentally testing positive, he's going to quite quickly know by talking to his team what it is. And so in this case, it's actually whether you're a doper or a non-doper in Klosterboll cases, you're actually really going to, maybe you could actually do it quite quickly. I don't know. Maybe it's one page. You could do it quite quickly in both scenarios. The reason why sort of you wouldn't expect that with more sort of serious substances, and I say serious in that you're allowed to carry sort of Klosterboll through airports because it's a non-prescription drug in Italy, whereas you wouldn't be allowed to sort of carry, you know, testosterone without a prescription through an airport. And so if you got caught with testosterone in your system, you wouldn't be able to automatically go, oh, well, I've got this receipt for testosterone. Let's just say it was testosterone that I accidentally applied. Because as soon as you admit that you're carrying testosterone, then you're going to have a possession case. And so Klosterboll cases could, I think in both scenarios, are going to be dealt with quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So actually, I would say, so I would actually go the other route basically and say probably is something that you can deal with. Maybe he had a heads up one day, I don't know, but even if he didn't, and even if it was only just before or something like that. I can envisage why it's not the most difficult, sort of legal document to put together.
But you agree that you need good people
Yeah, of
to do it.
course. If you're ranked 400 in the world, then you're gonna need a lawyer just to know how to deal with the process, right? Just to like where to apply, sort of.
Yes.
So yeah, it's gonna take a little time.
Speaking about lawyers, two of Sinner's lawyers in this case from the law firm Onside Law, Jamie Singer, one male person, and Kendra Potts, one female person, have also represented the ITIA in the past in other cases. Potts is not is with another company now and is kind of a freelancer, so not working permanently for Onside Law, but kind of a freelancer. And Potts worked for the ITIA on the case of Tara Moore, which I noticed, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, who did not appeal her provisional suspension. I spoke to experts or to law experts, and they said it's common that freelancer lawyers, or they work for obviously different people, they take cases, they work for different companies. But I can say I was shocked a bit to see that there are lawyers who defend players and then on other occasions defend the ITIA. If I speak from my position as a journalist, and we also talk about that often, me as a freelance journalist, I'm very careful which job I take. And I do a very limited number of public relation jobs because I want to be seen as independent and to work properly on my topic. So just weeks ago, I worked for the first time for a tennis tournament to do a colleague of mine a favor and also make a bit of easy money and don't get involved in a tournament. And obviously, I didn't ask questions about it, but I can't do it on a regular basis to stay independent. And for me personally, it's not a good look that two lawyers in this case have worked in the past for the ITIA. Am I too harsh, or do you agree on that?
I guess, yeah, well, sort of, once you know a lot about anti-doping, and the way it works, the same lawyers, I wasn't familiar with this lawyer before, but the same lawyers tend to work for like every organization, the anti-doping agencies and the wider world has their sort of trusted lawyers, and you can. You know that, yeah, they just sort of get to stay, and it even applies to like more senior positions in anti-doping agencies. You just sort of, some lawyers and some officials sort of just work the system, and they, get paid a lot, and so you always have this sort of conflict of interest a bit in anti-doping. It's a pretty common thing, and I think in this case, obviously, there's nothing that we can point to in terms of why this would have caused a problem. But of course, in an ideal world, we all would prefer to not have Sinner's lawyer having represented the ITIA. And I think just on like a very sort of basic point, as in like if you have one lawyer who's never worked for the ITIA and is like totally foreign to them, then the communication from them is going to be much more difficult. It's going to be more, it's not going to be so fluid. And in a case like this, where the facts were agreed on before arbitration, that this was a contamination case, sure, albeit Sinner and his team were investigated by the ITIA investigators, and it's not without reason that they didn't find any concerning inconsistencies. But at the same time, when this lawyer has worked for both sides, of course, then to come to this arrival of the summary of facts, it's going to be easier than if it was,
Yeah,
Jason Smith from
I just imagine,
Colorado.
if you have good contacts to both sides, obviously you can hold a lot of background talks. You can call a lot of people in background talks and maybe beforehand try to get in a certain direction where you want to go with your client. For example, there's another
No,
angle.
it doesn't give the best impression that sort of that this case
Yes.
has been dealt with in sort of the most aggressive way, sort of, so in anti-doping, you have a strict liability, which is it's on the athlete to prove why the substance wasn't taken. If they don't challenge the case, then they've intended to cheat, basically. That's going to be the ruling. And therefore the onus is on Sinner to do that, as in like the ITIA's base position is that they could have gone to arbitration, like arguing in an intent case, and then maybe other things would have been more heavily scrutinized, at least at the arbitration phase. And so obviously, and then when so you have this sort of like agreement, before of the summary of facts, and you have this lawyer who's worked for both sides. Obviously, it doesn't. You would prefer, and I'm sure Sinner's side would prefer that wasn't the case. But but ultimately, everything's been dealt with sort of correctly. But ultimately, Sinner's team have made this mistake. Sinner's team, who's trusted and who's been praised, his ascendance to the world number one. Ultimately, they've made this mistake, and whether he's cleared or not, it's damaged his reputation, and ultimately, this will always be a mark on his career, and ultimately, that's a punishment in itself.
Mm-hmm. On another point, just to give you this view, Sinner's team also hired this year in early summer a public relation expert. That worked for many years for the ATP as a public relation agent, so handling the journalists at tournaments. So I was in contact with that woman as well. She was very nice to me in the first years, did her job very properly, and is obviously very good connected in the tennis world, and is now taking care of Jannik Sinner and his public relation things.
I would say one thing that didn't sit so right was when the ATP made the press release. Mm-hmm. They said they're very encouraged to learn that Sinner has been found at no fault or negligence, and then in that press release they referred to him by his first name, Jannik. And this is slight, in such a serious case it's unnecessary to be so familial, I think. Mm-hmm. in a press release. And so, yeah, I think, yeah, on those sort of 3 points, I think, ideally Sinner would have sort of preferred that to have not been the case, for credibility. But Sinner seemed very relieved when he gave his press conference, I thought. It's obviously been on his mind a lot, but he seemed incredibly relieved for it just to be out, at least.
What we didn't even mention is obviously that he was cleared with no fault and negligence based on probabilities. So that's also maybe important to say, yeah. But I have the same impression. What I wanted to say with the angle, with the ATP person who is now working for him, obviously, as such a player, number one player, who is up in the rankings, who is up in the earnings, who has a lot of sponsors, he has a very good team around him, a professional team around him to give him the best treatment in every area of his professional life. Yes. 1 hour, 38 minutes talking about doping in general, and obviously
yeah,
the
I think it's a natural
case.
End, yeah.
To give a summary about the Sinner case, or like what are we taking with us from all these things we talked about this in a case, if you would have to summarize it?
That whatever way tennis wants to address its doping issues, whether it's been plagued by inadvertent doping cases or advertent doping cases, this is not a problem that's going away. Doping is endemic across professional sports. And tennis can hide from it as much as they want, but the problem's going to keep coming back.
Good point. Do you have anything to add, something that I forgot to mention, an answer, a question that you want to address?
No, basically, I guess first off is the response to the article that I wrote on Klosterboer has been so positive that I will be publishing It's obviously going to take me a bit of time to prepare it, but I'm going to be publishing probably a three-part series on doping in tennis. You'll be able to find that on my Substack, omnisport.substack.com, and that will go straight to your email. Probably will take me 3 to 6 weeks, probably, but
Nice.
that is my plan. And then widely, what else did I want to mention?
I just look in my preparations that we did together, and there's one point still open. So we did good. We did great, Edmund. We came through very well, but there's one point open. In order to win anti-doping cases, the ADO has to be aggressive. ITIA boss Nicole Sepstedt never has been. And you referred to a case about the boxer Tyson Fury, if you want to talk about that in
Yeah,
general.
so the ITIA took over anti-doping responsibilities from the ITF, I believe, in 2022. And since then, they're operationally independent. So that means that they're not ITF employees. And so that does bring a good level of distance, whether it's enough, we can discuss in the coming weeks. And since then, there have been more high-profile doping cases in tennis.
Yes.
But at the same time, the Sinner case and the Halep case were both from in competition testing. So I think Sinner's second positive was while he was still in Miami for the tournament.
Yeah, what I learned from you is that you can call a test an out of competition test if it is taken until midnight before the start of the tournament. Which is a very good point to know. So it is considered as out of competition, which I always considered as you have to be at home at training or in your area, and then some random guy comes to you and tests you, in the best case, urine and blood. But what I've learned from you a few years ago is you can already be at a tournament, which obviously every player is. For example, Jan-Lennard Struff, if he plays a Grand Slam, he is in New York. It starts tomorrow, but he's already in New York since last Monday. So at least for a week to be professional, to get used to the area, to practice that. You are tennis fans, you know that. And the tournament starts tomorrow, so if you get tested today on Sunday, it's still considered out of the competition test.
Yeah, so it's either 24 hours before your first match or 24 hours before the competition starts. So ultimately, for true transparency, the best thing would do would to be have in competition, out of competition, and pre would just be pre-tournament testing, because you obviously know you're going to be more likely to be tested when you're at a tournament.
And then the
But yeah,
authorities fuck
just to
up
go
their
back.
statistics.
Yeah, well, the ITIA doesn't publish. So the ITIA has better transparency than the ITF, but they don't publish a breakdown now of which players are tested each quarter. You know why they don't do that? I don't know, but yeah. But my initial point was, despite the fact the ITIA has done a better job than the ITF, the Sinner cases and the Halep cases aren't from out of competition random testing. So you do have to wonder, sort of. Yeah, if there was sort of more aggressive out of competition testing, how many more cases would we have? But that's sort of going a bit away from the point that we were going to mention. But you brought up that in order to really prosecute big cases in anti-doping, you have to be aggressive. As in, it normally takes to have a director who's really aggressive to like prosecute cases. And in my time, there's been sort of three who I've spoken to, one in Spain, one in Portugal, and another in Germany, and they're sort of no longer in the system, really. They all did really great jobs, but they kind of sort of spoke out about sort of the problems and really prosecute cases. And the head of the ITIA is a lady by the name of Nicole Sapstead, or Nicole Sapstead, and she was at UK Anti-Doping up until I think
Which is
2022,
the which is the
and
British which is the British anti-doping agency, just for
yeah,
clearance.
and we had a few cases with British cycling, where just UCAD just wasn't sort of aggressive enough in sort of what they did. But just to like be very specific on one, that we had the case of Tyson Fury, who I guess quite a lot of people know now,
Yes.
so the world championship boxer, and he tested positive for nandrolone before he fought, which is an anabolic steroid, before he fought Vladimir Klitschko, I believe, in Germany. Tested positive in February. And he was not charged with an anti-doping rule violation until June 2016, which just happened to be, I think, one day before the story broke that he tested positive in the newspaper, in the Mirror. Obviously raising questions that they charged him once they maybe got a comment from the newspaper and they realized this was coming out or whatever. The proximity's right there. And this took 18 months, basically, or 15, 16 months in order for them to be charged. They have to be charged immediately, or not immediately. They have to be informed immediately, but still, well, why has it taken 16 months? And then what was interesting about that case is when he was sanctioned from after his world championship fight versus Vladimir Klitschko, despite the fact he tested positive a few months before. And it's like always in these cases, of course, you're going to have your results disqualified from, you know, the moment you test positive. And so this was just a bit of a cushy deal because it meant, you know, national hero Tyson Fury didn't lose his heavyweight title win, deemed a no contest against Vladimir Klitschko because he tested positive months earlier. And so when I say it takes an aggressive director or head of operations or whatever in an anti-doping agency to really push for these cases, it really does come down to the person sometimes. Mm-hmm. And obviously in the Sinner case, as I mentioned, the ITIA didn't make the case that Sinner had intentionally cheated at the arbitration. Sure, they'd done their entire investigations. And a just general point is that, yeah, you have to go after these cases to win them, basically.
You have to go to the edge.
Yeah. So UCAD spent, I think, £600,000 on that Tyson Fury case. And so you understand sort of the magnitude of it. But yeah, it's sort of, otherwise, what else is anti-doping for if you don't really push these cases to the end? Then, which is an increasingly sometimes an opinion that I sort of actually think it isn't that bad, is for there to be testing and anti-doping rule violations, but maybe just to have shorter sanctions at this point, because, you know, like the NFL being banned for 4 games, maybe that is the best way at some point, because then at least the athletes are still being tested and then have full transparency of when they sort of test positive. And then at least people know. And that's ultimately what people care about. You know, someone's always going to come back after 15 months, 17 months. And then and maybe that's the way. Just then at least the fans know.
But like, you know, that we often talk private, and that's exactly what we mean by it's just entertainment. If you reference now to the NFL or NBA, they are not conducted under the WADA code, so the NFL can do what they find right and give players sanctions for matches. We all know the Justin Edelman case a few years ago that was caught with steroids, got a few matches banned, and in the same season was MVP in the Super Bowl. But tennis, as most of the other sports, are under the WADA code, and there is the normal rule: if you get tested positive on purpose for a banned substance, then the normal sanction is 2 years.
It's 4 years now.
Huh?
It's 4 years now.
I'm sorry. Yes, which is quite a long time. And if we would not do that and say, okay, every sport handles itself, then every sport would acknowledge that this sport is just entertainment. I consider the NFL as entertainment because I will get a lot of hate for that quote from NFL fans. The the number of German NFL fans increased a lot in the last 10 years. It's a very popular sport out there, here in Germany. I'm not a big fan of it because for me, in my personal opinion, it's just a show, and a lot of players are on drugs. And me personally, I don't want that. I don't want to be a sport, be like that. And that's why I fight for tennis and for a more for a cleaner sport. It's not entirely clean. I think a lot about how clean it is or how not clean it is. But because I got your point, but that's exactly sometimes people come to me and make this stupid statement. And they say like, yeah, Yannick, why are you talking so much about doping? Why they don't allow it? Let everyone do what they want. And still the best will win, which is stupid, because if we do that, then people will die.
But this is a bit more subtle. I'm saying allow it, but just have lower.
I understood you.
In the sense of not allow it, still punish it, of course. But
yes.
Yeah, I guess on that note, as in what I would say is sort of to be a bit more constructive, as in sort of, you know, talking with. Finishing off with sort of no bans or whatever, but to be a bit more constructive, it's like tennis, which I said at the beginning, tennis has many 196 doping cases since sort of the late 80s. Mm-hmm. Doping's endemic in all sports now. The way athletes dope applies across all sports is the same substances. Tennis players have tested positive for all of those major substances. And it's like now, at a point, we've had these two high-profile cases. The credibility of players to talk about it is to say, we do have doping in tennis. Sometimes at night, I do think maybe my opponent is cheating. But sure, but I don't think it's that much. I don't think it's that bad. But then have the conversation in that can happen. Because when these players say there's no doping in tennis, it just looks really bad for them. It's just not into, it's not sort of like, it's not showing good integrity, really. And that's what creates the biggest concerns. And then on top of that, why don't the tennis agencies go and find out what is the prevalence of doping in tennis? Go and take this anonymous survey from the WADA prevalence tool and go and put it out there at all four slams and all the masters and see what the number is that comes back. And then you can, and then if it's low, deny that there's doping in tennis, right?
Yeah.
That's my take.
It's a good take, but you know that won't happen because then they would admit and give bad news, which is in the end bad for the big sponsors that pay for the slams. Was nice talking to you. The last point about Nicole Sepstedt, which is now the head of ITIA, which was also in charge when we did the story for the Daily Mail about the testing with notice at least three tournaments.
Just say the ITIA has done a much better job in recent years, still, but obviously context is always important.
Yeah. They have very good people there. Yeah. But in the end, with that big cases, and I think that was what you wanted to imply, the head of the company is important to be aggressive. Nice, Edmund. Nearly 2 hours. To our listeners out there, I hope on YouTube and on every podcast you listen to, I hope we addressed a lot of topics that give you a good opinion and you can think about this topic, not only about the Sinner case, but in general. That was our goal. It's complicated. It's not always black and white, but I hope you enjoyed it. And Edmund, do you have one last thing to say? I only have to say thank you for, with preparation, more than 3 hours for our podcast. And also greetings from Daniel Masur. He is very thankful that you took the time.
Nice. Yeah, I would just like to say tennis is a great sport. I'm a tennis fan. I've got favorite tennis players. And so, it's not, the two things aren't mutually exclusive. You can talk about doping, you can love all the great tennis players, but just to, yeah, precisely. Stan Wawrinka, lovely player, Ivo Karlovic, my favorite player.
No, for real.
yeah, I would say so. And yeah, and so it's not all doom and gloom, as in just have an intellectually engage with the topic. And yeah, to any of your followers and stuff like that, if you have any follow-up questions, I have a comment site at the comment section at the end of all my articles. Yeah, just leave a comment under the tennis articles, and I'll get back to you. Happy to answer questions, and yeah, hopefully come on the Advantage podcast again. It's been very enjoyable.
You have to come again because there will be new cases, I'm quite sure. And
Precisely.
we will continue to report about that topic. Just a reminder for you, on Twitter, you find Edmund with the name Honest Sport. His Substack newsletter, you've
Underscore EW. Yeah.
underscore EW. On Substack, the newsletter, which is increasing from every week. Is also on the sport. Highly recommend to follow him. Very good. And for our podcast, you can find us on Instagram at advantage underline podcast. And if you listen via Spotify, it would be lovely to give us recommendations with 5 stars. Leave if you watch on YouTube. Hello, leave a comment and a like and a follow. We are quite new on YouTube. This would help us. Yes. Famous last words. Thank you, Edmund, and have a great Sunday evening.
Thanks, Yannick. Great. Take care.